From Islamic Finance News, the world's leading Islamic finance news provider, this is IFN Podcast.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back from lunch. I hope you guys had a really, really good lunch. So we are starting the second half of the day with a really exciting topic, really looking at a really current pertinent trend, which is Islamic ethical investments. And in fact, tomorrow we have a whole day at the Securities Commission just focusing on this area. And I have, you know, as Angela mentioned, an esteemed panel here from different backgrounds, and I'm really excited to go to dive into this topic. Essentially, we know that Malaysia is the leader in Islamic finance. And when it comes to Islamic ESG, they also have a really pioneering position in that we were the first to issue corporate sukuk. You know, the regulators have taken the lead in forming and engineering proper regulatory architecture to enhance the market. So this panel, we're going to spend the next hour to really understand how Malaysia can maintain its position, what we can do better, right? I love questions. So at the midpoint, I will open up the floor to any questions from delegates. So if you have any questions, do keep that in mind, and my colleague will pass you a mic when we open the floor for Q&A later. All right? So I will want to open the panel with the first question, which is to everyone. When it comes to Islamic ESG, and if you have to name one factor or one point, what is Malaysia's single most competitive advantage when it comes to Islamic ESG? What?
Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. For me, very simply, the fact that Malaysia is a leader in Islamic finance. A lot of the structures that you see in the rest of the world, we've come up with it first. Some people didn't like it maybe at first, and then we tweaked it a little bit here and there, and we have, not to say perfect harmony, but at least we're getting towards there. So yeah, that's my answer.
Amit?
Yeah, thanks. And good afternoon, everyone. And it's a very interesting question, actually. Why Malaysia has become a leader and what will probably sustain it in the future, right? So personally, from S&P Dow Jones perspective, what we have seen is that Malaysia has really developed a very deep connection between its Islamic financial institutions, regulations, as well as the clients. So you have leading Islamic finance banks here, okay, and they basically act as a bedrock supporting the whole industry. And then again, a significant demand from the investors, as well as a regulatory body which is highly supportive of the development of Islamic finance in the world and Malaysia in particular. So those are the key criteria which is basically pushing Malaysia totally up front. Thank you.
Dr. Aishah.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much for having me here. It's been a very long time since after COVID I participated in such a panel discussion. So I would say that for me, it would be Sharia governance. As we know, Sharia governance is the backbone of Islamic finance industry. And whenever we say something is Sharia compliant, that simply means that it should be ethical as well. Therefore, I believe that having dual Sharia governance is the most, the one thing which we are different from the rest of the world is that because the moment you have good Sharia governance, we are saying that we are doing ethical as well as sustainable things as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Vinita. Assalamualaikum and good afternoon. I'll try to answer your question from a fund management perspective. I think it's not just one factor, but two factors in Malaysia that makes us unique. For example, the first would be tax incentives, and the second would be regulatory initiatives. At FIMM, we conducted an investment management survey about 2 years ago to ask the industry, what do they need to grow this ESG space? And basically, majority of them were looking at the existing tax initiative as well as regulatory support, of which it has been coming well. And this is evident by the growth that we have seen in the fund management space. Thank you.
Great. And on that point, you talk about tax incentives and regulatory support, right? My next question will be, how, as an industry, can we actually leverage what we already have in Malaysia to maintain leadership in, you know, Islamic or ethical investment asset management?
Okay. I think in terms of maintaining leadership, as far as Malaysia goes, we are on the right track, because I read this report by Ernst & Young about trending sustainable, responsible investment in Malaysia last year. And basically, it shows Malaysia at the advanced stage of several categories when it comes to ESG matters. For example, green definition or taxonomy, sustainable debt market, sustainability risk management, sustainability disclosure, index, as well as policies to mainstream sustainable finance. But this is also thanks to the orderly development of the ESG SRI roadmap for Malaysia. If you have been tracking it over the last decade, since 2014, Malaysia has introduced several measures to promote ESG and SRI investments. So starting from 2014, you have things like a SRI Sukuk framework, you have the FTSE for Good Bursa Malaysia Index, and so on. Specific to fund management again, we have a Wakaf feature fund framework, and there's also an Islamic fund and wealth management blueprint, as well as certain mentions in the SC Capital Market Master Plan 3. So all these things provide the foundation as well as the building blocks for the industry to grow on. And what is evident is this. We conducted a survey in 2021 to ask the industry what is their appetite for ESG funds within the next 8 years up to 2030. So from the cumulative responses that we got, we were told that they are looking at launching at least 107 ESG SRI funds by 2030. Today we are at 2023 and there are about 66 funds launched to date. So that augurs well for the industry. Maybe I'll pause here for a while.
Sure. That's really interesting statistic. Dr. Aisha, if I can address the next questions to you as a bank or, you know, investment house, you know, what strategic steps can we take to grow Sharia compliant asset under management in Malaysia?
It's a very good question and a very relevant question as well, because we're talking about having new products in the market and expanding our market in a cross-border manner as well. So first, I would say educational initiatives are really important in terms of making investors aware of not only their rights, but what are the types of products available in the market itself. Things have changed. For instance, today we are not talking about the traditional products which are available in the market. For example, we're not talking about shares or sukuk investments. We're talking about crypto assets. We are talking about things that we didn't have in mind long time back. And when the market has transformed this much, have we done enough to engage our stakeholders and let them understand the types of risks, types of availabilities in the market, so that at least they will be there to help us to grow? Next would be product diversification. Now, when it comes to product diversification strategies, it's important to understand that we can't rely on the classical legal frameworks to issue these new types of products. The regulatory frameworks also should grow, as well as we have to have a very convenient and conducive market to have such products. For instance, a long time back, we were talking about crowdfunding platforms, but today we understand how crowdfunding works, and we were also talking about how to integrate blockchain technology, artificial intelligence, all these technological progress into our system. But today we somehow understand that we have to go beyond that, and to go beyond that, we need to have more different types of products which are not only available for retail investors, but to sophisticated investors and institutional investors as well. So I believe that new product introduction is important, and we need to have new strategies for that as well. Thank you.
On that note of like new products and crypto assets, I think it's only natural my next question goes to Fuad. You start us off by letting us understand how is technology and digitalization actually shaping the whole Islamic investment landscape?
It is essentially giving us the fertilizer to innovate. We're here, and I've been to these conferences before, right? 14 years in the Sukuk market before this as an asset manager. And every year that we're in these IFNs and all this kind of stuff, we're always talking about innovation, innovation, innovation. There is a team in the SC called Islamic Capital Markets, and they're always, they'll give the CEOs of the asset management companies a call. They'll give them a call, and they'll ask them, hey, what's the new innovation that's happening? And how old is ECF? How old is P2P? Right? So literally, the innovation is right here at our doorstep, and I'm happy to say that we're part of that change, right? Heligen Capital is Malaysia's first digital asset fund manager, licensed by the SC. We've got clearance to invest our clients' money into crypto assets, and we couldn't have done it without the regulatory clarity between Bank Negara and Securities Commission. First of all, in many other jurisdictions, they're not sure whether to classify crypto as a currency or a security. Over here, it's very clear. It's absolutely clear. So once that's clear, it clears the path for us to create a crypto asset fund, right? Even better, the Sharia Advisory Council of the SC in 2021, that's 2 years ago, have already come up with their resolution saying that the investment into crypto assets is permissible. Of course, certain ones that they have vetted, and that's available on the FC's website, but they've already said that that's permissible. So really, we have all these pieces of the jigsaw puzzle that needed to come together. And honestly, if we did it with Sukuk, we're doing it again with digital assets. That's what I feel in Malaysia.
Okay. So obviously, this is also a panel about ethical investments, right? So from an asset owner or an asset management perspective, right, what more needs to be done to mitigate social or greenwashing? Because that's a huge challenge of the industry.
I honestly don't really think it's a really big problem in terms of greenwashing specifically, right? And that's because somebody from the previous panel, I think it was from ICMA, made a very, very good point. It's not a new thing because it's just being in breach or fraudulent of your contract. Inside your prospectus or info memo, you were saying that you were supposed to do certain things and you didn't do it. That's technically illegal. You can get taken to court for that. There's actually precedents of people lying on their information memorandum and then being that being taken to court. So it's not a Sharia matter. It's not what you call sustainability matter. It's a matter of not making misdeclarations. And that's against the law, in case anybody forgot, right? So I would say that we've got strong enough local legal frameworks and enforceability of the law and good precedents that I think a lot of this is tail risk, in my opinion. And if they're fraudulent, then the courts will bring them to justice for sure.
Anyone wants to add to that? Amit, my next question is, when we talk about Sharia screening, ESG screening, can we say, are they like independent from each other, and how do they actually affect the investment universe?
Thanks. This is again a very interesting question, and many of my fellow panelists have basically noted about Sharia and ESG compliance or choosing the product based on each one of them kind of interchangeably. So basically this indicates there's a large correlation between these two kind of products or these two kind of concepts, but there are some fundamental differences as well. So for example, going back to what you earlier mentioned about the products in Malaysia, for example, we launched the very first Titan index, and then there was an ETF launched in Malaysian market, but that was just a Sharia product. It was not an ESG Sharia product. But what we are seeing globally is that there's a big push, not just in Asia, but in Europe, America, that Sharia plus ESG combined products are being launched. So in just past 1 year, S&P itself have launched 1200 ESG index. We have launched ASX ESG plus Sharia indices. So it's just a global push. People see that you have Sharia at one end, then you can top it up by doing marginal or rather incremental change, and you can get both Sharia and ESG product together. And we have seen in various markets that it does provide some sort of alpha opportunities. So this kind of product innovation is what we are seeing in the market. But yeah, so there's differences between what Sharia is and what ESG is. For example, traditional financing solution like banks are not part of Sharia products, but they are part of ESG products or ESG indices, right? Similarly, pork-based products, they are excluded from Sharia, but they are part of ESG. So there are some sort of commonality. At the same time, there are some sort of differences. So on the commonality side, you will have alcohol or entertainment kind of product, they might get excluded from both ESG and Sharia kind of product, right? So that's the main difference that we see in the market.
You talk about, yes, the common commonalities, but there are also differences. And don't you think that actually, I mean, the Sharia universe in itself is already quite small. And you add another ESG layer, doesn't that limit your universe?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. And in fact, so I can give you the perspective from Asia in general, not just in Malaysia. And this is really an issue if you are keen on investing in products which are both ESG and Sharia compliant. So technically, these kind of products tend to have higher tracking error just because, as you rightly mentioned, you will have to exclude large number of companies. And if you have more and more exclusion, of course, it will result in higher tracking error. At the same time, this is a global issue. For example, ESG we are discussing here. People are trying to achieve net zero. At the same time, they have to maintain sort of tracking error balance so they do not underperform the market. So people are working with this dual challenge and trying to come to a solution, an optimized version, if I might add, which will give them a lower tracking error, at the same time ESG and Sharia kind of return. Hope it clarifies. Thank you.
Kyler, if I can circle back to what you mentioned earlier, you mentioned the Wakaf featured framework, which I think is an interesting development from the Malaysian market, right? So how can we sort of like assess the growing influence and potential of such a product? First, then maybe I'll then ask Dr. Aisha.
Sure. Maybe a bit of background here first. In terms of Wakaf funds, as far as unit trust funds goes, it is not something new. This concept did come out way back in 2017 through the Islamic Fund and Wealth Management Blueprint. It was mentioned in there. But however, only the last 2 years, we've seen a couple of unit trust funds being set up. In total, there are six of them now in the industry. Their AUM is still quite small. I think it's only about 70 million ringgit. Okay, but nevertheless, there is traction in terms of how it has been growing on a preliminary standpoint is quite positive, and I foresee that this would be a growing trend. But I think one thing investors should realize, unlike other unit trust funds, most of the time you go in to get your capital gains or your distribution from it. But when you go into a Wakaf fund, I think you got to accept the fact that you are doing a charitable deed, okay, which is very good. And this is something that a lot of investor awareness work needs to be done. I noticed that there are many of my members, as in the unit trust management companies, stepping into this space. This kind of reminds me way back in the 90s when Islamic funds were first growing in traction. Okay, and today you have got so many Islamic funds. So I do see similar signs there, and I believe that it's only a matter of time before you will get more products out there. Notwithstanding, I think another factor that is also affecting not just Wakaf funds, but unit trust funds in general now, is the lackluster performance in the market. So it's quite bearish. Okay, everybody wants to go into a unit trust fund and hopes to make money straight away. But unfortunately, it will take some time for it to grow. So all these kind of sentiments, it's not helping. But nevertheless, if for those who have invested in unit trust funds long enough, you know that the mid-term to long-term returns are better. So I think it's only a matter of time before we will see more positive returns there. Maybe I could just add on. during the pandemic or so, I was monitoring most of the private retirement schemes. Okay, those days, there were a lot of comparisons made between private retirement schemes and EPF and other unit trust funds. Surprisingly then, the Sharia private retirement schemes generated more than double-digit returns, most of them, I think. Okay, they had right exposures to healthcare stocks, rubber gloves, medical services, and so on. And that did help a lot. So I believe markets move in cycles, so will funds. And I hope to see one day that Wakaf funds will also play a significant role as far as Islamic investment instruments go. I'll pause here for a while.
Out of curiosity, in your analysis of these PRS funds, right, and the double-digit returns, did you also see the difference in returns for conventional and Islamic, or was it just an overall?
Obviously, there will be difference between conventional and Islamic funds largely because of the exposure to the banking sector and the financial sectors. I did not go into that in-depth research, but I think most of you would realize that if you're heavy into the financial sectors, perhaps maybe during the pandemic, you would have got lesser returns, some of them, okay, and vice versa.
If I could chime in, so I did some research we were looking at asset allocations for a client. Obviously, we were trying to see how much of crypto can you put into a conservative portfolio, an aggressive portfolio, for example. So we did look at S&P 500, the BND, versus HLAL and the SPSK, which are their Sharia-compliant counterparts. And this is a three-year study because that was what our computer could take before it starts overheating. But in that three-year study, which includes COVID and all those periods, we actually found that the HLAL and the SPSK exposure was actually outperforming the S&P 500 and the BND. Not by a lot, it's just shading it, probably like 1 or 2%, and depending on the period. So once you average it out for the 3 years, 5 years, it's a minuscule difference. But yeah.
All right, okay, that's good.
Sometimes you got to celebrate the small wins.
Yes. We take all the small wins that we can. Yeah. And Dr. Aisha, just on the note of the Wakaf funds, right? Do you agree with what Kalyan has shared? And really, in your opinion, how can we harness the potential of this asset class? Because obviously, I mean, I know, like someone said, it's too small, but it seems kind of optimistic. And, you know, so how can we optimize the returns as well as maximize the benefits, the social benefits to society?
Of course, we have a lot of potential of Wakaf, but it's just that it is underutilized. Now, if we talk about revitalizing the role of Wakaf, there are a lot of things we have to do. Number one, definitely we need to understand that the classical role of Wakaf is not what we see right now. Classically, Wakaf is used mostly for immovable properties, but now things have been changed. Even cash Wakaf is taking part a lot, and we see different types of Wakaf classes emerging as well. So we need to be aware of these changes in the concept of Wakaf, how we use it. Number two, I think it's very, very important for us to come up with new ways in which we could integrate the concept of Wakaf to Wakaf asset management. Now, if you look at the Wakaf ETFs, for example, we see that part of the revenue or the profit received could be given to Wakaf, but can't we come up with a concept whereby the primary concept we use in such an asset class would be Wakaf itself? So we need to think about innovative ways to do it. But having said that, my third point would be we need to change the clash of convictions we have among our investors. By this, what I mean is that the reason why, or the motive of our investors mainly to invest in these assets, are to gain profit. They are not driven by any good cause or doing something good to the society. So unless we change this mindset, it would be impossible for us to have Wakaf asset classes in a sustainable manner, because if there's no demand, then how do we come up with these types of products?
So are you suggesting that we should treat Wakaf as not a charitable product?
Yes. I think we need to change that. We need to come up with innovative ways to do that. And one of the good examples would be the Wakaf linked Sukuk of Indonesia. Nobody thought that it could take off, but somehow there are certain classes of investors who were convinced with that structure in that particular jurisdiction. But having said that, our jurisdiction is also very different. And we have unique challenges when it comes to Waqf. And one thing which I want to emphasize is we need to do two things if we were to revitalize Waqf. Number one is we need to have collaborative effort among the stakeholders who are dealing with Waqf. And number two is legal and regulatory harmonization is very, very important. Without having these two things, I don't see we coming up with so many innovative types of Waqf classes that could provide value addition to the industry.
So the cash Waqf link Sukuk in Indonesia is truly an innovative, or rather it's a hallmark product, right? It's a landmark product. Do you think something like that can be replicated here in Malaysia?
We did research on that, but theoretically, yes, it's possible. But having said that, there are a lot of legal inhibitions that we have to consider. As you know, Waqf is a state matter, and we can say Sukuk is kind of a federal matter, which in order to, of course, theoretically it's possible, but practically in order to do that, we need collaborative effort between the stakeholders, including the regulatory authority, as well as the state authorities.
I have one question for Amit before I open up the floor. So if you have questions, have a think before we get the mic over to you. You can also use your, I believe we have Q&A cards as well. Yep. Okay, so Amit, you mentioned earlier that S&P has launched an Islamic ESG Sharia fund indices, right? I'm curious to know, how does that actually influence, or how do you see that impact the advancement of Islamic ESG sector?
Yeah, thanks. So we have seen tremendous growth in Sharia kind of ETF globally, not just in terms of AUM, but in terms of the number of products too. So if I remember correctly, the total AUM under these products is more than $2.5 billion now. And the ETF is close to 30. Okay, and we have seen in the past 7 years, almost 30% year-on-year growth on these kind of products. So it's a global phenomenon and just not limited to one particular geography. And yeah, so overall, we are pretty bullish about this kind of structure. And people are increasingly accepting this fact, as the panelists were mentioning about the regulatory pressure as well, not only on the Sharia side, but on the ESG side too. So many of the countries are signing net zero pledges. So basically, it makes sense for a country which is Sharia focused to include ESG or climate focused screening or tilt in their portfolio as well. And that's what we are seeing globally. And that's what explains the growth.
Thanks. So are there any questions from the floor? Feel free also to raise your hands. I have a question to Dr. Aisha. What is the best practice to ensure that sustainability of Sharia compliance in Malaysia within the ESG point of view? I think they're looking for policies and regulations. I suppose the question is trying to ask, like, how can we maintain its investment or practices within sustainable, but also maintain Sharia compliance?
Thank you very much for the question. Again, that is something which we always ponder at a theoretical level. But when it comes to a practical level, we don't see so many case studies or examples of it. So I would say definitely the first thing we have to do is we have to go back to the true objective of Sharia, whereby it is said that everything which is Sharia compliant must be ethically compliant as well. Therefore, when we come up with Sharia screening, we need to ensure that Sharia screening embeds the ESG or sustainable or whatever, the ethical screening standards that we have to follow as well. But we know that currently we don't have positive screening aspect embedded in Sharia screening. And therefore, even though we can say that there's overlapping of Sharia screening with ESG or sustainable or ethical screening, we don't see that at a practical level. However, I have to appreciate the fact that there are certain parties or companies in the industry who are taking such initiatives. They have come up with pilot projects. They have started doing it at a certain level. For example, one company is Wahid Investing, whereby they have disclosed in their website that not only they have a Sharia committee, but they have an ethical screening committee to do the screening as well. And another company is Sedco Investing, which is from Saudi Arabia, who also come up with a framework to do that. So I believe that in a nutshell, if I were to summarize what could be done or what is the strategy that could be adopted in this case, at a practical level, we need to ensure that we not only have the negative screening, but positive screening as a practice as well. And I believe that the Sharia screening methodology, which is followed by Securities Commission, is one of the example that we can adopt worldwide. Why? Because they have two-tier quantitative screening plus a qualitative screening criteria whereby image factor and other factors are considered. So when you say image factor, for example, let's say a company can be screened and the conclusion derived could be they are Sharia compliant company. But let's assume that in the market there is some kind of news saying that they are engaging child labor or doing unethical things within their company, which is not reflected in the Sharia screening criteria. That is where the qualitative factor will come in, and the image using the image factor, that company could be ousted from Sharia screening. So I believe that it is important in worldwide Sharia screening methodology we are having to have that type of liberty given to the screening bodies, so that at least, even though we don't say these are the list of positive screening, at least we have the liberty to oust those companies. So this is my answer. Sure. Thank you very much.
Want to add to that? Amit? This is a question to anyone on the panel, but I think maybe perhaps either Kellyon or Pua can answer. How is the EPF investment doing with regards to Sharia investment? Because they do have a separate Sharia portfolio. Is that something anyone can answer?
I'll give a quick one, and then Kalyan probably knows a lot more than I do. But I think we just see the announcements every year, and we can see that the Sharia EPF is lower. Lah. That's all. Stop.
I would like to comment more, but I can't because I still haven't transferred my money from conventional to Sharia yet.
Yeah, so full stop. It is like 1-2 percentage points lower, right?
Just compared about,
to, yeah. Yeah, just about. Any more? This is from Joseph, by the way. Hey, Joseph. Any more questions? Questions up front? Do we have a mic? We do.
Testing. So I'm here again. To answer that question, EPF, I think I made my point. If you have Islamic Bank stand alone, all right, spin-off, because what's missing in EPF right now is the banking sector income, right, and dividends. So if you do that, I think the gap may be much, much smaller.
Inshallah.
So okay, anyway, my question is this, or comment and questions, right? Now, if I look at ethical finance, yeah, we have been talking about ethical finance for many, many years already, yeah, and sometimes we can even associate ethical finance with state finance and vice versa. But what we are talking now is about, the next step, is about purposeful and stewardship ethical finance. Same thing with Islam, Islamic finance, okay? There must be a real purpose, even though we say we have, but we must really put it not only in speech, but in the programs, the plans and strategies that we have, and stewardship, which Malaysia, I think, well enough is good because we have got this political willpower, but then it cannot just stop there, not only at central bank, but at the banks themselves. So that stewardship, even for ESG, sustainability is important. Okay, now let's talk about how to maintain...
Sorry,
go ahead.
Duan, I just wanted to add to your example, Daddy Tao, because actually the first SRS Sukuk, if I remember correctly, there are a few arrangers in the crowd here, so kalau salah, tolong betulkan eh. The first SRS Sukuk that was actually issued was Ihsan Sukuk, a project by Khazanah. And if you ask me, that was the truest to the intent. Paling tulen pada niat dia, right? Tapi, I can tell you, yes, the bookmakers, this is where you cannot correct me, I know I'm correct on this one. The bookmakers will tell you, fully subscribe, fully take up, very good. Sebab semua member ambil. The special thing about this sukuk was, if they meet their goals, they pay a lower coupon. And it was for a very good cause. It was for building new schools, and then the KPI was to see whether the schools were built, whether they were built in good condition, and whether they were run well. So there was certificate of completion and post, right? But I can tell you the take-up from anybody who was not related to Khazanah or kena, okay lah, member issue, I pun kena tolong lah kan, was very, very poor. So I think, really, the capital markets, especially the buy side, I used to be from buy side, really needs to take a good, long, hard look at itself. And really, even if it's only 5%, 1%, whatever is the percentage that the board wishes to espouse to be really going for these goals, I think they need to start setting these goals. I can tell you that the private sector, the buy side, are not setting these goals. So I fully agree with you, Tuan.
Any more questions?
You had a follow-up comment, Pastor. Oh, ya ke? Kita lanjutkan lepas ni, Tuan.
So, you bring up a really good point, the essence of it is a good example, right? So then I suppose, but realistically speaking, we're all in here just to make money. And how you talk about changing the mindset, it's going to be quite tough, right?
Yes and no, but we've done it before and we can do it again. We've become a leader in Islamic finance, we've become a leader in Sukuk, and now we are essentially at the cusp of a very new innovation, right? Which I hope that I'm championing as well, which is building the digital asset world and building from scratch that we make Islamic finance relevant again, okay? And on a global stage. But what I must say is that it actually can be done. And a lot of the things that have been done, SRI, Sukuk, all these things, actually came about from the regulators, from the master plans first. It all is top-down driven. So if these things are top-down driven, why aren't the biggest guys putting their money where their mouth is? Out of the three big GLICs, four or five GLICs, who has signed the PRI? Satu dua je. Even then, have I seen them actually putting out ESG mandate to the fund managers?
Even Islamic banks, it's only a handful.
The crickets are making the sound now. You know. So it has to start from there. Even for dollar sukuk market, all these things, who was the one who started it? Bank Negara. There are some ex-Bank Negara staff here, so they know the story. There was a seed fund for dollar sukuk, they farmed it out to eight fund managers, then the dollar sukuk market started. The Naga now is issuing, Khazanah is issuing, all these guys are issuing, so it needs that spark. So why is it missing when it comes to this socially responsible thing? That one, I tell you, is a big question mark.
Yeah. Anyone here wants to answer this big question mark?
So, very valid points raised by you as well as you. Fundamentally speaking, if you are an investor, of course you are looking for return. And a return, as we all know, it comes in cycles. So for example, I was looking at the numbers. So S&P Global Sharia Index, it basically outperforms the conventional market indices. If you look at the rolling five-year return, almost 75% of the time. So three-fourths of the time in the past 10 years, if you look at the rolling return, Sharia does better than conventional, okay? Now, of course, what we have seen in the recent market, 2022 was really bad, especially for emerging markets, Sharia-based investments, and hence the funding has dried up, people have lost appetite. But it is interesting to see how the future look like, because all, not only the retail investors, but institutional investors have to think that, okay, it's all cycles. Nothing lasts forever, as he was just mentioning. We have done it in the past, so we'll do it again. And you are mentioning about Bank Nagara. I remember almost 10 years back, I was working with EPF, and they launched one of the first fixed income SRI mandate using 4 local and 4 basically global asset managers, and they were one of the pioneers in this area. So institutions, especially the government-linked ones, they have to take the leadership, and then they have to wait for the right time. That's what I have to add. Thank you.
I'd like to add something as well. If you were to change the mindset, I think we need to change the strategy as well. Instead of always focusing on institutional investors, we understand that even if we take the example of Ihsan Sukuk or Sukuk Prihatin, the moment we give the chance for the retail investors to invest in, they have different types of goals when it comes to investment, and they are more willing to take risk in terms of foregoing their profit to do good. So I believe that it is high time that we realize this and open for retail investors to participate in this type of a market. Maybe then we can see success in this regard, just like how we have seen it in the case of Indonesia when they opened the Wakuf Link Sukuk as well.
Yeah, I do agree with that. It's interesting that, you know, as advanced as Malaysia is, we are kind of lacking in terms of retail sukuk participation. It's only a handful. Sukuk Prihatin was one, which was done digitally. And then actually, the Ehsan Sukuk, they did open to retail investors after the initial one, right? I think it was done through a crowdfunding or P2P platform. And you rightly mentioned Indonesia, which has great success in the retail. You can just, you know,
move off and invest. In Maldives, if you look at the investors, we always open for retail investors, and retail investors take more than the institutional investors in terms of yes
right.
number.
Yeah.
And long time before we didn't have pension fund. So before the pension fund, it was dominated by the retail investors. So I think it depends from market to market, but it is high time that we even try to have that type of a strategy here as well.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for Fuad, because I think you're doing something really interesting. Helogen recently introduced or launched Malaysia's first Bitcoin fund, right?
And the world's first Sharia-compliant...
Sharia-compliant Bitcoin fund.
There's not a lot of times that Malaysia gets to be the world's first, so I do believe we should celebrate the big wins also, not just the small wins.
Absolutely. So, but cryptocurrencies are notoriously, I won't say controversial, but like energy intensive. There's no lie about that, right? So how do you reconcile that?
Well, it's a good point that you said notoriously. I would say that the people reporting this are the ones who are notorious. I didn't have a chance to put any slides on screen here, but I have credible research from many, many different parties. In 2021, the Bitcoin network estimated at least 41 metric tons of CO2. Sounds like a lot, right? 41 metric tons. That's less than banking, gold, aviation, and this is the best part, all other non-crypto-related data centers. Our Facebook and Google is taking up more than Bitcoin is, right? That's one. Number two, September, very recent report, Bloomberg Intelligence. Anyone from Bloomberg here? No? Reports that early estimates of generation mix that's being mined, used to mine Bitcoin is actually 52% from renewables. And this is a very interesting point, because Bitcoin is only as dirty as the grid. If your grid is dirty, then Bitcoin is dirty. So why are they not introducing more renewables into the grid? I hate to say it. I mean, we've made some great strides at SRI Sukuk and all those kinds of things, aligning Islamic principles with the sustainability principles, the SDGs and all that stuff. But the Energy Commission itself, what are we actually doing in a substantial way to actually move away from energy mix? Here in Malaysia, it's only, what, 15%? I might be even being kind when I'm saying 15%, right? So, yeah, I would say that there is a lot of... What's the reverse of cheerleaderism? Naysayerism, maybe. There's a lot of naysayerism in financial media, and particularly TradFi-related financial media about crypto. And I've been on that side as well. I was consuming the Bloombergs and all this kind of stuff for 14, 15 years, and I was a severe skeptic of digital assets and the blockchain. And I will have to say, now that I'm forced to do my own primary research and go and see it for my own eyes, it's actually a very, very different story out there.
So you were at the other side. Like, what converted you?
What converted me? Bitcoin going from 69,000 to 17,000. That converted me. Because at 69,000, it was the biggest bubble that the world had ever seen. And to me, doesn't matter what your fundamentals, your cap M model is, nothing rises 6,000% without dropping, right? And it did. So at that point, I asked myself, if this thing's going to survive, let's do it. If it's not, it's going to be relegated to be some kind of has-been asset, just like Dutch tulips or maybe even Japanese real estate.
Okay. Yeah. Good. We have another question for Kalyon. This is from Yusuf. He would like to know, as far as like Islamic ethical asset classes in Malaysia, what are, in your opinion, what are the most interesting or has the highest potential to grow? Which asset class has the most potential to grow over the next 3 to 5 years?
Thank you for that question. I have never sold a single unit trust fund in my life, although I was licensed to do so. And as a regulator, it's quite a moral hazard for me to recommend a fund. But nevertheless, I'm going to come from my personal perspective. If I go back on that high risk, high return analogy, then it has to be something which is very risky. And of course, it'll be probably small cap equities, or maybe Fuad can later top up here as well. Okay, so what I've seen over the years, many, many years ago, I think in the 90s, there was this fund sold by a very Chinese-based company. Okay, I think it was BHLB then, and they sold an Islamic fund. If I'm not mistaken, it was Dana Al-Ihsan or something like that. Dana Dali, they call it Dali. So it was an Islamic fund that really piqued my interest because they had many non-Muslim investors. Okay. And they went in not because of the Sharia principles, but because of the returns. And that fund was so successful that it came up with a sequel fund. I was working at the SE then, approving funds. And that was the first time a fund company was actually launching a sequel fund. It captures back the same essence and so on. And what they had was just equities. Okay, so where I'm trying to get here is this. To answer your question, obviously it has to be equity. Probably risky equity shares if you want high returns. But please, please, read the prospectus. Always remember past performance does not reflect future performance. And another thing, I want to tumpang Doctor's point just now about investor awareness. There is a serious need to educate retail investors today about what they go into, more so with pressing retirement challenges. Post-pandemic, we have seen everyone is suffering, okay? And everyone is trying to go for returns that is... FD returns today, I think, is not something that you look at last time. Even those who took ASNB financing or so, some of them have to refinance their ASNB loans just to make sure that they have enough dividends to pay off their yearly installments. So these are things that people have to consider. And what we are seeing on the ground today is if you have a good Islamic sukuk product, maybe an Islamic sukuk fund that can offer you, say, 5% returns or so on, I think you've got something strong there already for people to jump in. And that would encourage more retail investors to go into those products. What's exciting for me post-pandemic is this. During the pandemic, the unit trust industry experienced its best years in the last 30 years. Okay, we hit an all-time high of about 530 billion ringgit in terms of NAV. And we also had about 2 million new investors into the segment. Within that space, people were talking about, oh, you cannot go and market, no physical contact, no social contact, and so on. But yet, that grew by about 10%, and that was very encouraging. I believe more retail investors are coming into the picture now. It's just guiding them to the right investments that suit their needs. So that's why today I was quite excited, you know, when I met Fuad a week ago and he was telling me about what he has planned, and that does add to product variety. But back to you, Yusuf, if you want to go into something with high returns, you better have a high risk appetite. I hope I answered your question, Yusuf.
We have one more.
I guess Yusuf in this case should be a sophisticated investor then.
We do have a question from Matthew. It's not really an investment question. It's more of a Sharia question. I'm just going to raise that and see, Dr. Ashok, maybe you can answer it or not. So how is KPKT or the Housing Ministry money lending license company claiming to be Sharia compliant when they're not audited or answerable to either Sharia advisory councils of the SC or BNM? Money lending license company, right? So they're licensed under the Housing Ministry. So I guess his question is, how can they claim to be Sharia compliant if they don't have to answer to any Sharia councils of BNM or SC?
Okay, so there are two ways of achieving Sharia governance. One is through the formal regulatory approach, and the other one is you yourself regulate. So I believe that when you don't have a regulatory authority who checks Sharia compliance, you self-regulate the Sharia compliance aspect as well. For instance, the company can come forward and say that we follow the IOFI standard, and then we'll have to ensure that in the website itself, proper disclosure is made how IOFI compliance is done, or if they follow a specific Sharia standard, which is available in Malaysia or any other jurisdiction, they have to disclose that this is the adherence they are making when it comes to Sharia compliance. So I believe that in the absence of a regulatory authority to be a watchdog, you self-regulate. And when you self-regulate, you have to have check and balance. You can't just merely declare yourself a Sharia compliant forever. You have to have internal Sharia control mechanisms, such as Sharia audit, Sharia review. So
yeah, and in Malaysia, the people who can do these audits are regulated by the regulators, right? All right, last chance for any question.
Sorry, we're going to add on to that to that interesting question. I had an analogy that popped up my head, right? It's like going to eat lah at a restaurant. You've got one restaurant, you've got the nice Jakim Halal sign there, it looks really nice and official. And the fella next door, it was very cheap, but it looked really good and they're giving a lot of meat or whatever. And then you see the sign and it looks like, okay, they've drawn the Arabic correct, but it looks really wonky and something's wrong with it. You berani ke tak makan kat sana? So I think regulation is there for a reason. People need help. Everybody needs help. I need help when it comes to a lot of things. I'm not a Sharia expert. We lean on Amani advisors to do our Sharia advisory, right, for us. So we all rely on experts. And for people who are looking for this expertise, I think it's important to educate. It's important if we see these bad actors, to call them out. Because if we don't call them out, and this applies to everybody, but as a Muslim specifically, speaking as a Muslim, there is this concept of fardu kifaya. Right? What you owe the community. And if you don't report that somebody's doing shady stuff, somebody else may fall victim to that. Right? So we owe it to ourselves as masyarakat to do it. Yeah, that's for me. Cheers.
All right. So if there are no more questions from the floor, I would like to pose this question to everyone on the panel. Really just to wrap up our session. So in terms of Islamic ESG and how we are, where we are today in the industry, are we comfortable with how we've achieved this status? And really, what more do you think needs to be done, must be done? What kind of support do we need? What does the industry need to do so that we can truly develop and nurture Islamic ESG?
So I spent 2-3 years trying to market a fund. Right, which was the first wholesale fund, the first fund of its kind, really, in the country, to only invest in the SRS Sukuk alone. Right, so it was really working within the frameworks, working within everything that was given to us and stuff to go out there and make this work. Right, and at the same time, Bank Negara is clamping hard on the insurance guys. I want to see your compliance to the climate change taxonomy, all that kind of stuff. But I can tell you that so many people. It's okay, we'll wait until we get fined or something and then we'll act on it. But a lot of people had that very ostrich and put their head in the sand kind of approach. So, I don't know, probably needs to be a little bit more of the carrot and the stick to make things happen. I've talked about some examples about how it can be successful. We've done it before. Dollar Sukuk market is much bigger and better than it could be if there wasn't that initial push from Bank Negara. So I do think there needs to be something substantial from that point. Yeah.
Okay. Amit?
So yeah, good points. There are a few things which are important if you want to make the market bigger. So you have to offer new products, for example. But the fundamental thing that we have discussed throughout the session is that the returns should be appealing to the investor. If the investor think that they can get better returns somewhere else, then of course they will try to put the money there. And especially in the region, we have seen that people are very yield hungry, okay? And hence, for example, people tend to invest in REITs. And this, what we have seen, is somehow lacking in case of Malaysian Islamic market. So if I compare, let's say, our own index and see how many REITs are represented in there compared to the conventional one, the Islamic indices has only 2 REITs. Titan has 0 REITs. And the total weight in the broader Malaysian Islamic index of REITs is less than 2%. Now, if there's some fundamental change in how you include more REITs or those kind of products, high-yielding products in the Islamic fund portfolio or product in general, then it will become more appealing to the investor. It will shoot up the yield, and it will be very appealing for in general compared to the conventional market. So some sort of product innovation is required. And of course, for this, everybody has to work together, regulators, fund managers, product providers. Yeah, so that's my point. Thank you.
Dr. Aisha?
I think a changing of the mindset is required among the stakeholders. In this sense, I think we need to ensure that there is active shareholders engagement, and we need more impactful investing in the market, in the sense that without impact reporting, we can't do that. So when it comes to stewardship codes, of course, we do have it right now, but we need to enhance the role of these codes to ensure that everybody is on the same page. Because right now, some are driven by profit, others are driven by costs. So in order to for us to come into the same page and do the same thing, we need to ensure that we are aware of what is out there. And it's not only about profit. Therefore, we need to change our mindset. Thank you.
Thank you, Kalia.
Okay, I hate to say this, but most football club managers will normally say this. We have to trust the process. Okay, and when I look at it now, we've got building blocks, we've got foundation, we've got roadmaps, we've got regulators being very supportive. Okay, but we also have to take cognizance that we just came out of a pandemic. There are still companies struggling, there are people struggling. Even though retail investor base may have grown, but I don't think most of them have that extra money to really invest substantially. But nevertheless, if I look back at past incidents, Asian financial crisis, global financial crisis, I think this time it's a bit better for us because the building blocks are already there. If I look at past crisis, they usually say that there's a dearth of talent, there is lack of investable instruments, there is lack of substantial or high net worth investors. But today when you look at all these categories, you can see that there are pockets of people there, there are pockets of talent there. So I think it's just the timing. Okay, the good thing is the frameworks are all there, regulations are all there, regulators are receptive of all these ideas. You see a lot of product variety out there, so just wait, trust the process. I won't be surprised, maybe by next year, we can have this talk again, if I'm invited again, and we can probably sing happier tunes, you know. Maybe Fuad would launch more innovative products by then. So with that, thank you.
For sure, for sure. And I think that was a really good discussion. We touched on, you know, quite a few topics. I know it's quite macro level, but we did also have quite a few good questions. And if you have any more questions, I'm sure any of our experts would be very willing to take this discussion off stage later. We, like I mentioned, tomorrow we have another event just focusing on Islamic sustainable finance and investment. We're going to talk about regulations, product structuring, so on and so forth. So, you know, if you're interested, do swing by Securities Commission for that event. Please, you know, join me and, you know, give my panelists a hand for
your wonderful session. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more discussions on the Islamic finance industry, log on to www.islamicfinancenews.com. You can also listen to IFN Podcast on your favorite platforms, including iTunes and Spotify.